welcome to another episode of Pod of the Gaps, the podcast which seeks to plug the gaps between the church and the culture. My name is Aaron Edwards, and I'm joined this time, thankfully, listeners, by Dr. Andy Bannister, who must have fixed the broken pipe that made him miss the last episode dubiously at the very last moment. Andy, how are you doing? How is the pipe?
The pipe is fixed. It's very exciting, Aaron. I mean, to go literally, I was making a cup of tea, about to step into the office to record, and suddenly there were shrieks and panic and, you know, 2 inches of water in the in our utility room. And my plumbing skills are not that exciting, so I was able to turn the stuff off. But there was, yeah, thankfully we know a good plumber at church. But today, actually, it's good timing, water, because right now there's a thunderstorm of all proportions, massive crashes and bangs outside and rain pouring down. So if I suddenly disappear, there's a watery theme.
We will definitely take that as divine judgment. If that wasn't already the case for you missing the last episode, something like that. There were shrieks and panic amongst the Pod of the Gaps listeners, for sure, when they heard that the great Andy Bannister was not going to be there for the episode where we discuss Islam.
On Speaker's Corner and Islam. Yes.
Exactly.
You talked about Islam in my absence.
Yeah, which was wonderful. So yeah, I know you did listen to the episode. So I asked the questions you might have asked. I hope
I listened to every word that you say. All right, Aaron.
You hang on my every word. I do.
Yeah,
those
police complaints don't write themselves.
Exactly. Right. Absolutely. But you briefly before. But we are going to get into a slightly different area today. But brief, just quickly before we introduce our very special guest.
Very special
today,
guest.
You did actually speak at Speaker's Corner, didn't you? You were with Jay Smith.
I'm only smiling because I'm listening. Can't see the smiling. What do I say? Just the bangs getting louder outside. This is quite the thunderstorm. Yes, I did 5 years every Sunday at Speaker's Corner. That was actually my journey into evangelism and apologetics, because I started going there in 1997. A friend of mine called Jay Smith, and you can Google Jay Smith and Islam, and people can find all about stuff Jay did at Speaker's Corner. I went along to Speaker's Corner, 97, was persuaded up onto a ladder, knew nothing, absolutely nothing. The Muslims there wiped the floor with me, but I felt, hang on a minute, I need to dig in and try it and dig a bit further. So that got me reading. And that caused me eventually to fall in love with, you know, Islamic studies, especially critical study of Islam. We're going to come to criticism of Islam on this episode, I think. And it started at Speaker's Corner. I moved away from Speaker's Corner in the end because I got frustrated that sometimes you can't get to the subtleties.
Yeah.
Of an argument, it is all quite sort of soundbitey, and there's nothing wrong with that. But what I learned at Speaker's Corner, I do use. I did a big dialogue the other day at a high school in Aylesbury. We had 300 students there, and there was myself and a Hindu and a Muslim, and an atheist. And the Muslim and I, she was lovely, but we definitely went toe to toe on a few things. And I thought it's like Speaker's Corner, just more politely.
I'm glad to know the Speaker's Corner has left its imprint on you, even if you're no longer gracing its. It's a hallowed spaces. So, but today we have a slightly different approach, and we have a very different kind of guest who probably doesn't frequent Speaker's Corner quite so often, but is still fighting the good fight in bringing the truth for Christianity and therefore against ideologies like Islam. And so we have Tim Diep from Christian Concern, the head of public policy at Christian Concern, and also a fellow of the Ezra Institute, with us today. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you. I think I have been to Speaker's Corner about once or twice, nowhere near every week for 5 years. I have to say that's too much for me. Great respect to Andy for doing that. But once
how
or twice,
on?
It is a very,
on,
very tough environment. If you can cope there, you can cope anywhere. That's what I say.
Maybe that's what they should say for all Christian Concern employees. You should just, you know, you need to have a couple of sessions if you can get through
Speaker's Corner.
Andrea marches you down to Speaker's Corner for your interview. Just says, look, I'll leave you here for 10 minutes and see if you survive. That would be quite useful. Yeah.
The link, though, before we get into the topic we particularly want to talk about, there is a link, is there not, in some ways, Tim? Because I think what Speaker's Corner perhaps in my view has in common with what you folks do, you know, Christian Concern, is sometimes fighting those battles, taking a stand for truth and what matters. It can be a little bit intimidating, can't it, at times? Mm. You have to be willing for people to attack you. You have to know that people are going to push back on you. And if you're someone who finds that a bit nerve-wracking, that's not always easy, because some of the you're not up a ladder, but you're in some very contested spaces, aren't you, at Christian Concern?
I mean I would say Speaker's Corner is very intimidating. There's lots of Muslims there. A lot of them are actually professional apologists, and you're out in there and people are heckling you, you know, live and shouting you down and all this kind of stuff. It's extremely tough. Honestly, if you can hold an audience there and hold you on there, you'll be a brilliant public speaker in any other environment. That's what I think. Hats off to anybody who's done very well there. And certainly I've seen it done very well, as you have by Jay Smith and Hatton Tash and various others as well. But yes, the different kind of public square, sort of being in the media, you know, our strapline is sort of speaking for Jesus in the public square, which we do in media and politics and law and so on. And that's a different kind of public square environment, and it has its different kind of roughs and weaknesses with it.
One of the things, by the way, but I do like about Speaker's Corner, which you don't see anywhere else, quite frankly, is there somebody who's only 5'8". The fact that they provide stepladders, I quite like that. I spend a lot of my time thinking, I wish I had 6 more inches. So Speaker's Corner.
We can get you on for part of the gaps. If we ever go to video, we'll get you a ladder.
Thanks for that.
We've got your back. But Tim, as you say, you're involved with Christian Concern, facing flack, not only as the likes of Bob, and no doubt Andy would have done, at times, from other Christians who don't agree with that kind of approach or that kind of evangelistic style or even public engagement. But you find yourself often, writing things that are going to sort of help people think in terms of public policy, as that's key to your role. And I think I saw you, I don't know how often you get on there, but I saw you speaking on GB News this week. And,
I've had a lot of media this week because we had this, obviously not Islam-related on the one hand, is this sort of gesture eggs. Did you see that story? Some outlet decided to call them gesture eggs instead of Easter eggs. And I thought this was a great opportunity to talk about the gospel, actually. Say, hey, look, eggs reference new life and the resurrection, and Jesus walked out of a cave and the chick walks out of an egg and the new life you have from Jesus dying for you. It's a great opportunity to get that into the media. So I talked about that. And then the other thing, which is Islam-related, is Azidi and his sort of fake conversion and what that means for churches and how we should respond to that as churches and so on. So I was on Sky News about that last night and stuff. So that is more Islam related and the interlink between churches and Islam and asylum and immigration and all of these complexities and conversion.
As an aside on that story, Tim, I'd perhaps love your kind of thought on this. One of the things I found fascinating in that story and slightly puzzling is that for many years I've had a very good friend of mine in Australia who's an Australian Christian scholar of Islam, a guy called Mark Dury. Mm-hmm. And Mark has written on radical Islam, among other things.
Yeah, I've read his books. They're very good.
Yeah, the third Choice, which is a phenomenal book. Well, Mark got, one of the reasons that Mark got drawn into Islamic studies, he was a linguist initially. His first PhD is in linguistics. He's one of these annoyingly brilliant people who's got two PhDs. Iranian and started showing up at his church in Melbourne when he was vicar.
Yeah.
And that congregation grew and grew and grew, and eventually he ended up with a larger Iranian than English congregation. But that led to a specialism in Islam. And one of the things that Mark did for a while is whenever the Australians had somebody at immigration who was claiming to be a Christian and claiming asylum, Mark, they got to know as a person they could call. And Mark said, I would regularly get phone calls. I'd go down to one of the immigration centers. And he said, usually within 15 to 20 minutes, actually, if you know what you're doing, you can begin to find out, if you ask the right questions, not the superficial, what's Easter all about. You actually get the backstory and dig further. And so looking at that, I am slightly puzzled, what's gone on with some of the fake conversion stuff, and particularly that story.
I think I was saying there ought to be a more rigorous process, really. I thought that one of the things I suggested was when converts are baptized, they ought to renounce their previous faith. So you ought to say, I renounce Islam, I renounce Muhammad as a false prophet, I renounce the Quran as not inspired.
Renounce the devil is in
and,
the...
I embrace Jesus as the only true God and Christianity the only true religion. Now, that makes it just a bit harder for fake conversions. And the other thing I was advocating, a bit more time of somebody living in community, sharing prayer requests, sharing answers to prayer, showing growth in character and in understanding of Christianity and in desire to share their faith and that sort of thing. And if you say we'll do that for 6-12 months or something like that, much, much harder to fake conversions.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And by the way, we won't go into it now, but I'll put a link into the show notes for listeners. And Mark Dury, who I just mentioned, the other great resource Mark's done is Mark has a book called Setting the Captives Free, which is a liturgy that he developed because he's an Anglican. They do like their liturgy, which is exactly that, Tim. So for a Muslim convert to Christianity, you can go through that process of renouncing Islam. What's interesting is many of the Iranians in his church in Melbourne asked him for it. They wanted the ability to spiritually cut themselves off from what had gone before. And so he wrote that and just become so
That's popular. Very interesting. I didn't know that. That's very interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think you're dead right. There's something in that spiritually significant, I think, in that break of the past. Mm.
And I think that speaks into the differences in how some churches will see certain markers or certain liturgical events or how they mark those. Because, yeah, with a transition in such a significant culturally embedded religion like Islam to become a Christian, I was talking about this with Bob in the previous episode, you know, how important it is for the church to care for the needs of that person because it's so culturally challenging for them to move, even in the UK. But it also speaks into something you mentioned earlier, your issue with the, what is it called, the gesture eggs.
Yeah.
Or the not cross buns, as we've also heard this year.
I like
which
a good
must
one.
Have been an Andy, but that's an Andy Bannister pun, that is. It's wonderful.
I wish I could claim that one, but no.
You should claim it. So Gavin Ashenden, I noticed, was quite appreciative of your stance there. Gavin Ashenden, formerly the chaplain to the Queen, the late Queen.
Yeah.
And he, of course, is also a convert to Roman Catholicism from... Yes. The Church of England. And so one of the things he was saying was, yes, we've forgotten the symbolic importance of Christianity in a culture. So many people look at those cases and say, why do we have to care about losing a silly Easter symbol? It doesn't matter. Jesus didn't talk about that. He's not worried about eggs and stuff like this, or the same similar debates at Christmas. But Catholics have a stronger view of, let's say, Christendom, don't they? They tend to have a bigger view. No, we need to have I think Ashenden even used the phrase, a sacramental society. I might not use that phrase.
I thought that was very interesting. I saw his comments on that and I thought, I think he's right, because I think that some sort of more conservative Protestants can overdo the sort of, you know, we don't believe in any symbolism at all. We don't really, I heard that one church, do you remember the story about the raves in the cathedral and that kind? A lot of people were outraged about that. And one conservative, well-known conservative church said from the pulpit, it's you've got a bad theology if you're concerned about that. It's just a building. Now, that's a pretty extreme view that a cathedral is just a building. Use it for whatever you want to. Who cares? You know, most Christians wouldn't go along with that. And only Protestants of a fairly conservative background would say that. But it is a kind of overreaction against the Catholic sort of aspect, which does value some of these symbolisms and sacramental aspects and so on. And it is emblematic of it. It does have a difference in our culture. And what was interesting to me was I went on a local BBC news show last night about it, and they interviewed members of the public. Members of the public were more outraged than I was. They were like, this is absolutely offensive. It's terrible. How can they disrespect Christianity like this? I'm never shopping there again. And I was the measured one saying, well, you know, I am disappointed kind of thing. So people, the ordinary people recognize it and see it and are kind of upset about the symbolism of Christianity being taken away from us. Of course, the other story to sort of bring it back to Islam today is we've got Ramadan lights here in London over Easter. I mean, Easter is the most important Christian festival that there is really in the year. And what are the lights and big show about in London? It's actually Ramadan. And that's a very significant indication, I think, of the cultural impact of Islam, that we are, you know, that the city is celebrating Ramadan while Easter is going on without doing something to mark Easter.
Yeah. The other thing as well, I think that ties those two stories together as well, is that, of course, Islam is a religion by its very nature. It's very structured, Tim, isn't it? Where actually there is quite a lot of emphasis on the outward. In fact, when I teach, you know, Islamic studies, I often say to students, you know, in some ways, you know, for Christianity, we talk about orthodoxy. There is that with Islam, but it's almost orthopraxis is more important. And so there's, you know, the outward praying, how you dress, how you look, the fasting, the Hajj, and so on. And I think one of the things I've been thinking a lot about in recent years, I don't know what the answer is, but I've just been found myself thinking a lot about it, is one of the challenges Christians have as Muslims, the numbers go up in culture, they become more obvious, because you can often look and go, oh, that's obviously a Muslim because of the way they're looking. Christians, particularly in the Protestant tradition, we don't dress a particular way. Many of us don't wear an obvious cross and so on and so forth. And I just wonder whether, as our society diversifies, but especially with the challenge of Islam, there may well be a need for good old conservative Protestants like me to go, maybe the time has come to be thinking about, is there a way of outwardly showing that I have some
inward
kind of faith? And that will require a bit of sort of re-theologizing.
Yes, the whole thing about wearing a cross or not and all this kind of thing. I mean, I remember reading Martin Lloyd-Jones, who said, who argued you shouldn't do that. You know, Christians shouldn't be visibly different in that kind of way, which is an interesting sort of angle on this kind of thing. But you know, I wonder about that. It will be interesting. But I think Christians will, as the culture is moving away from Christianity generally, is on the one hand, and LGBTs and all these other things on the other hand, they're going to stand out by virtue of their behavior and their attitudes, and their whole sort of worldview is so radically different from the culture, or increasingly radically different from the culture. And so I think that, you know, I quite often meet people who, or have conversations with people who say, oh, you know, I could see, I thought this person was a Christian because of something in the way they reacted to something at work or whatever it is, and then they were. Do you know what I mean? So I think it is in that sense going to be easier to identify fellow Christians in environments like workplaces.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. By the way, just as an aside, because we do need to get into Islamophobia. I realize that's a bad choice of words. We need to get to discussing.
Let's get going on that Islamophobia.
Islamophobia. But it's also that just to finish off that point Tim made there. Well, again, I often do sort of training sessions for, you know, Christians in the workplace or campus groups on how they can reach Muslims and so on. One of the things I'll often say is find those little ways around your Muslim friends to show you're a Christian. Something like saying grace. If you're not someone who regularly says grace at mealtimes, different Christians play that differently, do around your Muslim friends because they will notice that you are somebody.
Yeah, you're quite right. Outward signals like that are quite significant, aren't they, to Muslims?
And also, Aaron, by the way, I think this is I take Tim there as silently endorsing, it's time for Pod of the Gaps merchandise. You know, we need to launch the You want to say you're a Christian?
Pod of the Gaps is the way to show you're a Christian.
Is the way to show you're
better
Christian,
way to
mate.
Do it. No, you're right. But this, I mean, lest we forget, you know, where we'll get onto this Islamism, because this entirely relates to the Islamism issue. Because as you say, Tim, when you've got people on that BBC panel or that show going, members of the public who sense a cultural Christianity, we want them to actually become Christians and embrace Christ, not Christianity. And yet there's something that we fail to tap into, that they do recognize that as embedded somehow in their national cultural identity.
Yes.
And they are worried that people aren't standing up for it. We do often meet, you even meet Muslims who think Christians should stand up for their beliefs more. I mean, presumably not radical Muslims, but you do meet people who go, I wish Christians would actually stop allowing people to blaspheme the name of Christ or Jesus. Yeah. And even some have said to me before, you know, if they said Jesus, if they swore Jesus's name in Arabic, we'd be all over them. But it's just because it's in English, we'll give them a pass. But actually, they'd have more respect for Christians. I even had, over my stance against LGBT publicly, I had lots of Muslims come in and say, well done. And my stance was against homosexuality invading the church.
Yes.
And I wasn't talking about society, but they were, they're like, yes, we need to stand against
this. Well, they respect strength. I think they respect strength and sort of, robust defense of your view and that kind of thing. I think a lot of Muslims feel like Christians in the West don't really believe, or don't believe it strongly enough, or aren't passionate enough about it, or don't have a confidence to defend their faith. And they think that Christians are weak. Muslims tend to be upfront, unashamed, do the symbols and out there doing their dawah in the streets on Birmingham and Speaker's Corner and so on.
Yeah.
Very unashamed and upfront and bold and confident about it. And bold and confident in the influence on culture, of course, as well, more generally. And Christians, there aren't so many Christians that are bold about cultural issues. We're kind of one of the rarer sort of Christian groups that focuses on that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But a lot of the church isn't very engaged in cultural issues. And therefore, the church is seen as weak and not very interested in cultural issues, or disengaged from it, or viewing it as not spiritual, whatever.
Hmm. Yeah, and the naysayers to that would tend to say, oh, look, Christian Concern or Bob the Builder or whatever, or maybe Andy Bannister back in the day on his stepladder, too aggressive, whatever, too bold, and where's the grace, where's the humility, too much strength. Well, actually, there is humility and grace. There's certainly humility to go to Speaker's Corner. I mean, you've got to kind of die to your reputation in many respects to do that. Mm. But there's a sense of Christians needing to show the strength, but not the same kind of strength that the Muslims are wanting you to show or showing themselves. But how to show the humility and the grace alongside the forthright authority that is there in the Word of God? Because you get people from Iran, for example, who are so enraptured by the grace of God because they've never heard it. And so that's kind of amazing. Whereas sometimes in this culture, more antinomian culture, where we're kind of anti-law in many ways, or anti-doing stuff, we can say grace and it doesn't have the same effect on people. But but just to transition from the, I guess, the reaching Muslims issue, what would you say, Tim, just to start a, you know, what are the main issues you see for what we call, what is Islamism for one thing? What is Islamism? Mm. And what are the kind of main challenges you see for Christians facing that in the kind of near future?
Well, how to define Islamism is not a trivial question, is it, actually, straight off there? I'm going to define it as kind of, you know, here's one way to look at it. A lot of people say Islam needs a reformation and Christianity's been for a reformation and, you know, now is peaceful and happy and all this kind of thing. Well, the Christian Reformation involved going back to the scriptures, actually, going back to what the Bible originally said, going back to the original teaching. And arguably Islam is having a reformation right now in going back to the teaching, and you're getting these groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and various others. And Islamism is really true Islam in a sense, going back to the text, going back to Muhammad, following Muhammad's teaching, following Muhammad's life, and so on. And seeing, as Andy was sort of hinting earlier, a sort of political ambition as well as spiritual ambition is very clear in Islam. And so, you know, these Islamists, if we call them that, have political aspirations in terms of influence on the country, which Christians don't tend to think in those terms of terms. They tend to think about, you know, individuals who want individuals converted and this kind of thing, rather than political aspirations. And of course, we have the doctrine of the separation of church and state, which is not there in Islam. Islam, it's very much united, you know, state and Islam, and Islam wants to, you know, basically rule the state and so on. So the goal of Islamists, in a sense, in one sense, is to Islamize the country. And that the challenge is that, really, the influence of Islam, it's massively increased in the last 20 years or so. The number of Muslims in the country has doubled. The population, it's about 6.5% according to the 2021 census, and increasing, probably the fastest growing religion in the UK. And then the cultural influence, like I just said about the Ramadan lights in London, is just, you know, the latest example. But political aspirations in terms of trying to define Islamophobia law, which we can perhaps get onto, and other many other cultural influences, Sharia courts, you know, creating a rival Sharia system, in a rival legal system effectively across the country, Sharia finance, which is actually how I ended up in Christian CERN through coming into contact with that, and so on. And, you know, we're the first non-Muslim country in the world to issue a government Sharia bond, for example, which is governed by Sharia law. And then sort of in schools and education, you know, Batley grammar schools, back in the news again with the Khan reports and a lesson on free speech. Well, we all learnt the lesson there. We don't have free speech. And Wakefield School again, where, you know, the police got involved when a Quran that a boy owned was knocked out of his hands and slightly scuffed. That would never happen with the Bible. That would just never happen with the Bible. How come it happens with the Quran? Very, very indicative sort of, you know, sirens about where the culture is going in terms of, you know, people being so scared of offending Islam that a slightly scuffed Quran involves police and all this kind of stuff and death threats and everything else.
And the same way we were saying earlier that you wouldn't have a silent disco in a mosque, would you? we get in cathedrals.
So. No, yes, you wouldn't. And this sort of, you know, people sort of, you know, have this respect for Islam or fear of Islam, that means they won't touch it, they won't criticize it, and they'll go out of their way to bend over backwards and do what they want with it, which they don't have for Christianity. In fact, Christianity is actually the opposite. It's considered fair game to mock and criticize and rebuke and so on.
There's a lot to kind of dig into there. I mean, some of this is, I think some of this is not new, but the trends are definitely accelerating. I remember, you know, during the halcyon days of the new atheism, you know, that kicked off in 2006, if we date it from Wired magazine's cover article that kind of launched the phrase. I mean, it was very noticeable at the time that you had the likes of Dawkins were ready to go for Christianity like a terrier, but it was really only Chris Hitchens in his book God Is Not Great was actually willing to stick his neck out even then and criticize Islam. Sam Harris came late to the game. And then I think one of the things that today is fascinating, I think you've nailed it though when you say it's fear. I think it's fear, for me, it's fear masquerading as respect because people are well aware of what happens. And one of the things I found helpful, by the way, is always to bring other religions into the piece and to show that there's an Islamism problem. You know, sometimes people will say, well, it's linked to, you know, the Middle East or it's political of going. An interesting thought experiment is to go to, well, look at Buddhism. and look at what's happened in Tibet, where the Chinese government have systematically oppressed and terrorized the Tibetan people for over 50 years. That has not generated political violent Buddhist movements. There's been one or two examples of people going off the reservation, but it hasn't generated, you know, an ISIS. It hasn't generated an Al-Qaeda. And, you know, you talked about the – I'm so glad you made that point, because it is so crucial in this about the Reformation, because that's often thrown around lazily. And you'll be aware, but readers may not have come across – listeners may not have come across. Again, we could put a link in the show notes. Graham Wood, a journalist, a very famous article in The Atlantic a few years ago called What ISIS Really Wants, and then a follow-up book, actually.
Yeah.
And he makes the point, right? It's a prophetic movement. They're going back to the text. And I think people are not always aware, of course, that Muhammad – you know, when he dies in, well, the second half of his career was political and warfare driven. When he gets to Medina in 622, you know, he spends his time partly as a military leader unifying the Arab tribes. Yeah. But what I then think is fascinating, when he dies in 632, you know, his followers, his inner ring of followers, who presumably would have known what the game plan was, didn't sort of sit down and form a commune, but they launched the world's great empires. And that, by the way, is yet another thing which we don't have time to talk about today, but I think bleeds into all this, that it's interesting that the West is always up for fair criticism. So whenever it's imperialism, the West is talked about. Whenever it's slavery, it's the West that's talked about. And as an Islamic specialist, I'm always like, hang on, Islam had a great empire, massive empire.
Quite. And slaves and everything. And in fact, Muhammad owned slaves and sex slaves and all the rest.
Well, across the Arabic world today, the colloquial term for a person of African descent is the Arabic word abd, which is the Arabic word slave. Every Arab speaker knows this. Wow. And I remember when I went to Speaker's Corner back in the late 1990s, I had a really good friend of mine who would come and do Speaker's Corner with me, one of the team there with Jay. His name was Emmanuel. If I kind of lost touch, if he's listening to this, you can reach out. He was a medical student. He's probably a consultant now. And he was massive. He was about 6'3", and there was me at 5'8". He was African guy. And I remember back in sort of 98, not really knowing enough to know, why did Muslims use the word slave? They would shout out, oh, you brought your slave today. You brought your slave along, Andy, today to the corner.
Did they say that in English, did they, really? Wow.
They would say that in English. Jay, actually, if he heard it, was quite good at stopping and going to the crowd. Did you hear what was just said? I didn't know enough then to know what was going on. So, no, it was an insult that was thrown at African black members of our team at Speaker's Corner.
Wow.
Gosh.
Go on, Aaron.
No, I was just going to say, so just to move into the area, as we say, we're talking about slander from Muslims to Christians there in awful ways. We've got this kind of leads us into the sort of fears of the hate speech laws, doesn't it? And the stuff you've written, Tim, on Islamophobia. You also did mention Islamic finance. We'll get into that a little bit further down, perhaps, but on Islamophobia, one of these kind of key terms that's come up, which obviously Andy mentions, Christopher Hitchens, I think it was him who spoke. Was he the first one, not just among the new atheists, but I think he was almost saying it prophetically, wasn't he? So, you mark my words, this is going to happen. And I think he was saying it when the notion of it was would have sounded alarmist and laughable. Oh, don't be so silly. And I think he was one of the first to say, look, this is a term that's already coming up. One of these many examples where Christopher Hitchens was actually a friend of the Christian approach in many respects, despite being kind of dead against it. So tell us a little bit about what you've been, your work on this, because you've produced a report on this whole thing, which we'll put in the show notes, as Andy said. So, want to expand upon that a bit?
Sure. Well, so really this stems more recently from a proposed definition of Islamophobia proposed by the All Party Parliamentary Group on British Muslims in 2018. And if I just read the definition to you, it says Islamophobia is rooted in racism and is a type of racism that targets expressions of Muslimness or perceived Muslimness. Now, just reading that definition, it's kind of obvious there's so many problems with it. First of all, how is it racism when Islam is not a race? And all Muslims would agree Islam is not a race. So how is it racism? And it, you know, in that way, how is it racism when you can change your religion as well? And people do change their religion. And so, you know, that doesn't make it racism where you can't change your race, so to speak, but you can change your religion. And then it's Muslimness, whatever that is, not defined, or perceived Muslimness, which makes it very clear that it is entirely perception based. And if somebody perceives that you're being Islamophobic, well, you are by definition being Islamophobic because it's been perceived as Islamophobic, therefore you are. And
yeah,
we've had
yeah.
Police, somebody complains they're being Islamophobic, police come along and arrest you as street preachers. And so it's kind of, has the kind of effect in that kind of way already. But what happened was we came very close to this becoming an official government definition back in 2019. The government was set to make an announcement, and I was helping coordinate an open letter to the then Home Secretary, Sadiq Khan, about it, saying, please do not adopt this definition. It will restrict free speech. It basically endorses an effective blasphemy code. And that letter was signed by myself and various other Christian leaders, but also secular and atheist leaders as well. And Richard Dawkins and various others and National Secular Society were right behind it. And people were like, gosh, what is this? Christian Concern and the National Secular Society on the same page agreeing. And we were like, well, yes, because we actually do agree that we both want free speech when it comes to Islam. Thank you very much. And fortunately, the government decided not to adopt that definition. They appointed an advisor to propose another definition, and then more recently they abandoned that project as well. But what's interesting is the Labour Party has fully adopted this definition of Islamophobia, as has the Lib Democrats, the Green Party, every Scottish party, and all the major parties apart from the Conservatives have formally adopted it, which means that you can be suspended or thrown out of the party on an allegation of being Islamophobic. And this even happened to Sir Trevor Phillips in the Labour Party. Yeah. In spite of his high profile, somebody accused him of being Islamophobic, found some statements that he'd made that they said fitted this definition, and he was suspended. And I think, somehow quietly behind the scenes, Keir Starmer managed to get reinstated later on. But the precedent stands that somebody could be expelled from one of these parties for being Islamophobic, which means, if you want to protect your position in that party, you're not going to criticize Islam. So you have an effective Islamic blasphemy code within politics now. And can you imagine if Labour come into power and there are proposals and some quite aggressive proposals to make this a legal definition, who in the Labour Party is going to stand up against that if it's part of their code of conduct already? So you could quite quickly, if Labour come to power, this could be incorporated into a Race Relations Act, which they are proposing to do. And then you have an effective Islamic blasphemy code where it's actually a criminal offence to criticise Islam or say something about Muhammad or say something about... I mean, the definition is so broad. It can be about Islamic practice or doctrine or codes or what exactly. Muslims do or whatever. Even talk about Muhammad or history. No matter whether it's true or not, somebody says it's Islamophobic to say Muhammad did this.
Yeah.
There you are. That's perceived Islamophobic. Yeah. You are Islamophobic. Yeah. We are that close, I think, to being... effectively in a nation with an Islamic blasphemy code. And that is quite a landmark moment if you think about it for where we've come from as a nation.
I think a couple of things there. Straight away, there's a lot to talk about. One, I think, is just something you said right at the end where you talked about even effectively telling the truth or just even that perception of Islamophobia. Because the other story that you tell in the Islamophobia kind of report that you did with the Free Speech Union, that I say we'll put links to in the show notes. Most of the material in there I was familiar with, including the Trevor Phillips story. The one I didn't know so much detail on was the story you end with, which is Stephen Greer at Bristol University, who was a very well-regarded academic, teaching a course on human rights that actually criticised quite a lot of religions and societies. He got a complaint, filed against him by the Islamic Society there. But one of the statements that he was, they tagged as Islamophobic was that he had said Islam spread rapidly through war, conquest, trade, and conversion. And I remember reading that thinking, well, that's completely fair. That's utterly balanced. He hasn't just said
that most Muslims would agree with that.
Well, every step of the introduction. On my shelf behind me, I have Andrew Rippin's Introduction to Islam. It's the standard university textbook we all teach from. We teach this stuff, and it's got chapters on all of those, recognizing it was a mixture of those things.
It's going to have to be a book burning, isn't there?
My word! but what that leads to, and I think to me the most worrying thing in all of this was, and you touched on it there, was that the whole question of perception, Tim, perception. That my
but it's worth just finishing on the Stephen Greer
story, isn't it, though?
Because you know he'd been teaching this course for some years. It was a highly respected course. When it was reviewed which courses to continue with, this one was like ticked off. We're definitely doing that course again. And he criticized various cultures, and one of them was Islam on the basis of human rights. And then one year, some students complained and said this is Islamophobic, and that the Bristol Islamic Society kicked up a big fuss, and university reacted, suspended him, and eventually sort of ditched that aspect of the course. And yeah, then claimed nothing had done wrong. But who's going to teach a course that criticizes Islam now?
Well, that's
in any university across the country.
Yeah.
Well, that's my very. Do that if you risk losing your job and nobody's standing up for you.
No. Well, that's my very point where I was going. Of going, so that you talk about the perception. So, when you say in politics, it will have this chilling effect. Already, is doing media, but academia, because that's part of my world, not mainly, but part of. One of the things I have noticed, Tim, that deeply concerns me is that if you want to do critical study on Islam. So if you decide, I want to do a PhD looking at the textual changes in early Quran manuscripts, you have a real problem on your hands, because most universities will go nowhere near that. For me, the textbook example of this is down in London. You've got SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies. That was the academic home to two giants in Islamic studies, John Wandsborough and Gerald Horting, who in the sort of 80s and 90s, early 90s, were, I mean, leading the Western world in critical, not i.e. attacking, but just looking, asking critical questions about the origins. Now, I mean, SOAS is a war zone, but across the university scene, I would say across the Western world, most universities are terrified of asking critical questions. So instead, if you want to do a PhD or higher study in Islam, you're going to end up being taught, you know, something on the lived experiences of Muslims, some sociological aspect, you know.
Or you go abroad, or you have to take it abroad. I mean, that's where we are. You can't do deep critical study of Islam here in this country. That's where you already are.
Anyone who asks me, and I regularly get asked, I send them to Australia. I teach at Melbourne School of Theology, which is a Christian institution, but is very well regarded. You know, it's those.
You send them to the place where we used to send criminals. But the course you came and did at Cliff, of course, Andy, that took me a long time to get through the panels at the University of Manchester.
Yeah.
And originally I wanted to call the course Mission to Muslims. And the thought was, we can't assume you're actually wanting to do mission to Muslims. So I still think it was quite impressive we got it through, really. We call it Mission in Islamic Contexts, because it doesn't necessarily state you are evangelizing Muslims or going into Islamic context to do mission. But hey,
you know, it's going to become anything. I used to speak in Turkey, I haven't been for some time because the person who used to bring me out there is no longer doing the role she was. But I did quite a few missions in Turkey, and it was always a running joke when I spoke in Turkey that I was always briefed. You can say a whole kinds of things, but you mustn't refer to Muslims. You have to refer to our friends in other faiths. Yes. So how do we have conversations? And every Christian in the room would know you were talking about Islam. But you couldn't say it. So so this is coming here, I guess, then, Tim. This is what we're looking at, unless things change.
I think we are effectively censoring study of Islam already in our universities, and that's very concerning, isn't it? And that says a lot about where our culture's at. You know, that filters down. You know, you can't criticize Islam. You can't openly criticize Islam. Even in a course on human rights, which is the Bristol example, you know, you can't criticize Islam, but Islam is clearly breaching human rights in lots of different ways in Islamic cultures. So, yes, I think that's very, very concerning about where we are as a culture.
Yeah, and on the kind of wider culture issue, you mentioned earlier, Tim, of course, our Christian reticence to have the same kind of agenda for changing culture. Now, Christian concern does have more of that kind of sense of the, whether we call it the Puritan hope, to use Ian Murray's term, or you know, the Manifesto of Hope for Society in Joe Boot's subtitle of his book, but the sense of
the kingdom of God, a wider vision,
the
of
biblical,
the, kingdom of God,
the thing that Jesus
on earth
spoke
has got
about,
to include the whole of culture, hasn't it? Right?
Absolutely, absolutely, exactly. The gospel of the kingdom, and so we ought to be reclaiming that. That's something we've talked about on this show before a few times in different ways. But you did mention earlier there is a separation of church. That we have a doctrine of the separation of church and state, and many Christians go, "Oh, great, that gets me off the hook." Because we don't want any Christians involved in politics in any way, shape, or form, or influencing it. But that doesn't actually mean that, does it? It actually means we separate them so that the church is not an ecclesiocracy. We're not ruling over them in the way that, as you say, in Islam, that precisely is the issue. It is like they want the equivalent of an ecclesiocracy. And so there is going to be this, what they're doing is entirely consistent with their beliefs. And it does go into all strata of society, including things like economics. I mean, most Christians, we don't talk that much about economics, other than generally saying, let's join the normal leftward bandwagon on what make poverty history, or whatever the cool thing is. We'll just say, yes, that's right. And there's lots of things, of course, about poverty alleviation, which Christians have been right at the forefront of. But with Islam, there's a very specific thing, and you guys have published a booklet on this. I came across many years ago while I was on a stand for Cliff College at some event. And there was a Christian Concern stand next door. And I saw this booklet saying, "What's wrong with Islamic finance?" And I was like, "That is a niche question. if there's any, I have no idea what is it. Why is that a thing? Why is that a question one needs to ask?" And I picked it up, and I had no idea about this whole like system. So, would you want to elaborate on if anyone is confused by that question? What is Islamic finance?
I wrote that booklet. I joined Chris said about 8 years, and I wrote it pretty early on because it was. It was my background. I worked in finance. I was a fund manager in the city, investing on the global stock markets in the world. And for me, my entrance into being interested in Islam was 9/11. I basically saw that happening almost live in the newsrooms in our office in London, in the city. I'd heard of suicide bombers, but I thought they must be poor, illiterate, easily manipulable people. And here it was obvious it was actually the pilots, and they are not poor. They're highly educated. They're well paid. They're not manipulable people. And I was like, wow, what is this worldview that can motivate people to do that and to be so dismissive of human life? And so that was what got me studying Islam and reading about Islam and so on. And then I came across Islamic finance, and I thought, well, I work in finance. I really ought to understand this. Yeah. And so I read up about Islamic finance. And one of the things I found was the then chairman of HSBC's Sharia Advisory Board had written a book in English. And in this book, he asks a question. He poses the question, do we still need to wage jihad in a country like Britain where we can freely build mosques and preach Islam? And his answer to the question is, well, according to the Quran, killing should continue until they pay the jizya tax. The jizya tax is the subjugation tax for non-Muslims in a radical Islamic state. So I was like, wow, you know, here's this guy who is the chairman of HSBC's Sharia Advisory Board, and he's written this in English, you know, what's going on? So I wrote to a friend at HSBC and said, do you think this chap should really be on an advisory board? And he passed it on to their compliance unit, who had a panic and sacked him straight away. Wow. But they left his son on that advisory board, and undoubtedly the other, you know, imams on that board knew, if not most likely, sympathized with his view. And that really opened my eyes to the agenda behind Sharia finance is Sharia law. I mean, it absolutely is legitimizing Sharia law. If you say, oh, Sharia finance, that's fine, we welcome that, that's fine, much harder for you to then criticize Sharia family law, for example. So it's about legitimizing that. That's one aspect. The other aspect is to create a rival financial system based on this idea that interest is banned in the Quran or banned for Muslims. Which it turns out is actually a modern radical interpretation of the Quran. Muslims have always borrowed and lent with interest all the way through history, and most Muslims today still are happy to use interest. It's a radical modern idea. It's a bit like the Bible prohibits usury, so does the Quran prohibit usury. It's not a blanket ban on interest. And of course, you know, Islamic financial products actually, you know, just, you know, through smoke and mirrors are using interest anyway, just calling it rent or something else. So there are plenty of Muslims, moderate Muslims, who complain about Islamic finance as being deceptive because it really is based on interest ultimately anyway. But Western financial institutions like HSBC and others, that they'd subsequently closed down that board, but they, you know, 5 years later or something, but you know, they offer Sharia products on the basis that this is what Muslims need, and it actually isn't. Yeah. And the government offering Sharia student loans, and then actually in 2014 launching a Sharia government bond, is an extraordinary thing to buy into what's actually a radical interpretation of Quranic teaching and to endorse a radical system that tries to create a rival financial system there that is, you know, promoted by someone like that particular sheikh who was chairman of the HSBC Sharia Advisory Board. I was trying to expose this, and I wrote this booklet to sort of, you know, try and expose it to people and so on, and show people the deception of it, and that it is, you know, part of the radical Islamist agenda is to promote this Islamic finance. So why is our government endorsing and saying, oh, we're going to be a council of this. Yeah. It's kind of extraordinary.
I think one of the problems we're running into, I thought over the years, Tim, and I'd love your take on this in a moment, is that I think for folk who are secular, so which is a lot of our government and media and so on, they tend to assume, the default position is to assume all religions are essentially the same. So the assumption is that Muslims are just like Christians, but with beards and burqas. So like, oh, we understand the Church of England. They're lovely and cuddly and don't give us any problems. So Islam's largely the same. And there's that confusion.
Absolutely. The other confusion, and see, this is what happened to me subsequent to that kind of exposure of this HSBC advisory chat. Just a little while, I was sort of praying for opportunities to talk about Islam and to explain some of the stuff I knew to Christians and so on. And the answer to prayer I got was being asked to run a Sharia fund. And so it would have been my name, Tim Diep, manager of a Sharia fund. And I was like, well, I'm not doing that because I'll be endorsing Sharia law. And Sharia law is discriminatory against both non-Muslims and against women. And I tried to explain this to my colleagues, some of whom were quite radical feminists. And they weren't buying it. And part of the reason they weren't buying it is because they have this perception that all religions are the same. And when I explained to them, Islam, Muhammad was a warmonger who fought lots of battles, you know, highly educated, Oxford degrees, you know, in the city, people didn't believe me.
That's amazing.
They just didn't believe me. This, you know, don't be silly, that can't be true. He's a religious leader, you know? Just no idea about it at all. And, it was quite a stressful time for me because nobody was supporting me. And I remember being called into my boss's office at short notice. You shouldn't be talking about religion in the workplace. And I was like, case, we can't run a Sharia fund, can we?
You almost want to say amen. That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah.
And I connected with Christian Concern through that because I sort of reached out for help and ended up connecting with Christian Concern there. And then building the relationship there and ending up working here some years later. But yes, people have a sort of, you know, odd view about religion, a very uninformed view. We are a religiously illiterate society, really. And the view is that, there are these radical Muslims, but they're obviously not true Muslims. And the politicians keep saying they're not the true Muslims. True Muslim is peaceful. Do you know, my most read article ever is one called Is Islam a Religion of Peace? And remarkably, it was like number three on Google search for that for about 5 years, if not longer. Wow. It's now relegated to about number 10. But still, you know, I met someone the other day who's not a Christian who said, oh, yeah, I was looking for somebody to explain that to me. And I read that article and I sent it around to my friends because, you know, that explained it all. You know, because ultimately, if you go back, like we talked about the Reformation, if you go back to what Muhammad actually did, what Muhammad actually taught, this is not to say that all Muslims are violent. No. They are. Most of them are peaceful because they themselves don't know about their religion either. They're not encouraged to read the Quran in their own language and to study it themselves and to ask questions about it. But if you do go back, the actual teaching and follow Muhammad, that's how you'd want to judge the religion, and it's not peaceful, actually.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of my dear friends for some years until, you know, we lost him to cancer a few years ago was a former Muslim called Nabil Qureshi, who we've mentioned on this podcast. Yep. So Nabil's book, Answering Jihad, is interesting because he makes that very point, Tim, of going as growing up as a Muslim, you know, he was unaware of those texts. Then he began studying his religion, came across Muhammad's teaching on warfare and so on. He said, I realized with horror, I had only three options open to me. One was to become a radical Muslim and sign up with Al-Qaeda or whatever. The other was to jump through all kinds of torturous hoops to try and explain it away. But he said, but I was too sort of bright to do that. Or he said the third option was to leave Islam. Which he did. But one other thing I want to talk about briefly from something you said a moment ago, the other thing I think that's crucial here is that the way that the Islamophobia discussion, the Sharia finance, the bits that you've talked about there, what we're doing is we're spotlighting and centering that extremist form of Islam. Because yes, there's the text, but the majority of Muslims, as you say, aren't extremists. We've got a number of extremists who are quite terrifying, but you've got a lot who aren't. But we've taken this sort of Wahhabi, Saudi form of Islam and sort of assumed that's the default. And then the other thing I came across in terms of Sharia the other year, because I had a friend of mine who did her PhD in the Sharia court system and looking at the Sharia court system here in the UK, pointed out that Muslims, under Islamic law, if you're a faithful Muslim and there is no Sharia alternative, you are perfectly allowed to use the systems in the country that you're in. The moment there's a Sharia court system set up and you're a faithful Muslim, you are duty-bound to use that system. So often, you know, Western idiots will use the phrase, we're increasing choice by allowing Muslims to have things like Sharia courts. You're not. You're restricting choice. Because right now, if you're a Muslim woman becoming divorced, and going through family breakdown. You can use the secular system. You have all of the protections. The moment Sharia courts are there, if you wish to be faithful, you no longer have that option.
And let's remember that under Islamic teaching, a woman's voice is worth half a man's voice in Islamic law, and that would count as Islamic courts. And that is what's practiced there. And a lot of the 95% of business of these courts is actually divorces, because these women are, you know, the couples are married in a mosque and they don't realize that they've not been married in law. Yeah, and then their only recourse then is to go to a Sharia court if they want to divorce or somebody. Obviously, the man could just divorce saying, I divorced you three times, and so on. But the woman, who may want rights and her husband's left or whatever, has to appeal to Sharia court, and that's very, very difficult, and pay lots of money to do it and so on. So one of our campaigns is to enforce registration of these marriages, which then gives these women rights in law if their husband divorces, leaves them, or dies or whatever, which they otherwise do not have because they are not married in law. And even the Law Society has backed that idea now with its proposals, but it might take some years to come through. But I hope it does come through, that we actually enforce religious marriages being legally recognized in this country.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, in these elements of Sharia law, we remember, I think it was 2008, wasn't it? I was a young theology student at the time, and our
you're still young, Aaron.
Oh, good. Oh, thank you so much. Even with the beard, our lecturer came in and he bought a copy of the Guardian. It would be the Guardian because it was higher education, of course. Bought a copy of the Guardian for every person in the class. And he changed the lecture for that day to basically discuss what had just happened. It was on a religion, sociology of religion module about British culture and transformations of religion in Britain. And it was the day before, I think, Rowan Williams had made those comments about Sharia law, which made the front pages.
Where that phrase had
come out of, obviously, yeah, he was always classically saying, oh, I'm taken out of context. It was far more nuanced than they reported it. But, you know, Archbishop of Canterbury is, we've said many times, is the kind of person who can be quoted by two guys in a pub. And so it was, even that the phrase was legitimate. It wasn't like he was saying, it wasn't like he was reported as saying something completely different. He had literally said, it is inevitable that elements of Sharia law will have to be incorporated in our multicultural Britain. And so if we believe in multiculturalism, which we're not really allowed to question, we're told we're not allowed to, therefore it's inevitable. And so there's that more reticent approach, like let's just let this happen. But this brings me to a kind of maybe a controversial curve, but I'd love to hear both of your thoughts as you Islam experts. There's a book that came out in 2022 called Defenders of the West by Raymond Ibrahim, and he also wrote a book called Sword and the Scimitar about the wars between Christendom and Islam historically. So when you look at, in contrast to the Archbishop of Canterbury basically saying, let's bring a Sharia law here in some way or another, or the current Archbishop saying, aren't all these Muslim festivals wonderful, let's celebrate them and not really oppose Islam. Historically, we've had very different Christian approaches in the socio-political realm, where the church had more influence upon politics, not necessarily as an ecclesiocracy, but alongside it, and bringing a kind of conscience to the nation. How do you look at the way Christendom did defend the West against Islam? Obviously, we look at the Crusades and say, we tend to be told they're all absolutely terrible in every respect. But do you see some significance? I mean, the fact that some Christians did want to defend the West against encroaching Islam is basically the reason why it stopped at kind of Spain and didn't kind of encroach into Western Europe any further. So without that, how do we incorporate something of that today without going away crusading? I'm not advocating we go around crusading and take back Jerusalem.
First.
Well, first point to pick up on is multiculturalism itself, which is exactly what Andy Bannister's been saying about all religions are equal kind of thing, isn't it? You can't criticize any particular culture. All cultures are equal and so on. One of the articles I've written, again, that got quite a lot of traction is called What's Wrong with Multiculturalism? And you can just Google it and find it. And it critiques that very idea. And it's very important to do that. You know, we run a Wilberforce Academy for young people. And, you know, I have to explain, you know, cultural relativism, why it's wrong, and explain to them, you know, the various criticisms of it. And they've never heard criticism of multiculturalism before, of cultural relativism before, most of them. And you have to sort of point out the basics and say, no, obviously some cultures are better than others. Treating women, you know, with respect is better than not treating them with respect, and so on. And you know, Christians in bygone days would have gone and, for example, abolished sati in India, where you kill the woman, you know, when her husband dies, and so on, in the funeral pyre, and so on. And that's the opposite of culturalism. That's saying this culture is better; these moral rules are better. And this is the attitude that I think we as Christians need to recover, that Christianity is what is best for society and Christian moral values are what is best for society. And so we proclaim them not just for Christians, not because we want Christians to influence society because we're Christians. We proclaim them because this is best for everyone to have Christian values and Christian morals and laws based on Christian teaching across society and Christian values upheld in society, which includes, of course, family, marriage, best place for children, and, you know, disincentivizing divorce and encouraging marriage and encouraging family and so on. And, you know, that is what's best for society. And the more we turn away from these things and dismantle them and go ahead with no-fault divorce and various other things like this, the more we're going to see more family breakdown, more society breakdown, massive cost. What is it? The cost of family breakdown, $50 billion a year. You know, what a saving if we didn't have that. Yeah. You know, it's a huge amount, you know, and the economies, you know, and the government finances are problematic and so on. You know, let's get back to those things. And so it's about having a wider view of Christianity and what it teaches. And, you know, that verse in Deuteronomy, what other nation has laws as good as these? You know, these are the best laws for any nation, any nation, full stop. And so let's get back to that. And yeah, I don't know if that answers your question. We can come back on the Crusades if you want to. But yeah, that's the kind of thinking.
I see Tim's done a great job there because he's done a wonderful answer there and left me to deal with the...
he's left the Crusades to Andy. Andy is our resident Crusader on the podcast. Any comments?
Thank you for that. And
Andy Lionheart.
Well, the funny thing is, I mean, on that point, actually, Aaron, is to go, you know, I... One of the, you know, what's instrumental in my coming to faith was being part of a wonderful, you know, church youth movement in the 80s called Crusaders. It was phenomenally good youth work. And I was brokenhearted, actually, when they changed the name. I understand why they had to do that. They're now Urban Saints. But actually, that imagery of, you know, you're confident in what you believe. Not going around bashing others, but, you know, it's interesting how the imagery's changed. Just on the Crusades, I mean, Tim did a great answer there on multiculturalism. A couple of thoughts that's often missed out is that, yeah, people were starting to say the Crusades were a failure and a disaster for all kinds of reasons. And there was a lot wrong with them. And obviously, the Crusader states didn't last for long in the Middle East. But what I think a lot of more, you know, sort of balanced historians would say is that what the Crusades did is create space. They gave Europe breathing space to recover and get itself ready. Because we had, you know, we had in 732 when the Muslim armies got as far as the border of France and were turned back. Well, I think if the Crusades hadn't happened, you know, Vienna could easily have fallen and fallen sooner, quite frankly. And what's interesting is the way that's viewed differently in different parts of Europe. I used to do a lot of teaching in Eastern Europe before the pandemic, hasn't kind of restarted yet. But there was a town in Hungary called Sopron that I would sometimes go and speak at a big conference there called the European Leadership Forum that happened every year. It's now happened in Poland. And in the middle of Sopron, I vividly remember there was a statue of a Hungarian Corsar, a soldier, beheading the last Turk they had driven out of Hungary in that period. I remember looking at that thinking, there is no way that is going to go on the extra plinth in Trafalgar Square. Sadiq Khan is not having that. But they were very aware that they had almost fallen to the Islamic
army. Well, of course, it's worth mentioning as well that you know, the Crusades were a reaction to 400 years of Islamic persecution of Christians, right? And if you think about, you know, ISIS today, our equivalent is sending troops in to recover these nations from ISIS or something like that. You know, that's the kind of way in which they viewed it. You know, the Muslims are persecuting Christians heavily, destroying their churches and so on. We've got to do something about this. We can't just let it carry on like that.
Exactly.
And that was ultimately the reaction. I don't think it was all entirely good, but, you know, the best book on it, I think, is Rodney Stark's book. You've probably read it, God's Battalions, which is a very good take on the history of the
Rodney's work, and there's others as well. The other final point I was going to say as well that I think is really interesting, because it does tie into the Islamophobia thing, is that lots of historians have remarked that when the Crusades were happening, they barely registered on the pages of Islamic historians from the period. The Crusaders were an annoying blip. It's like a sort of wasp that you've got to brush off and deal with. They were far more concerned with the threat from the Mongols coming over that side of the Islamic Empire, because that was much more massive, much more existential. The Crusaders were an annoyance. What happened then was in the sort of post-colonial period, you know, mid to late 1800s, when, you know, Islam is really wrestling with what's gone wrong. We wanted a great empire, and now we've all become Western colonies. That's when certain writers, you know, Islamic writers, grabbed hold of the Crusades and used it as part of a narrative that the West have always been against us. We've always been victims. But you go back in history, that was not always the case. And the same, by the way, we talked about this at the start, as having with things like slavery and colonialism, that Muslims have grabbed hold of those things to weaponize them and critique the West. And I would say, by all means, critique the West. We are not perfect by a long way. But then you forget, and it's what is not talked about, is Islam's own track record here. And I go, I'm, you know, as someone who cares about history, I think history matters. And so we need to, you know, be willing to talk about where all societies have gone wrong historically. But then, as Tim said, you know, I think as Christians, to recover our confidence in going, you know, what the Bible says about the way to, you know, structure society and some of those big sort of questions about what does human flourishing look like. We don't hold to that as Christians just because we think it's a nice idea and other people got nice ideas and let's all just, you know, downplay the importance of our nice ideas. If we believe the Bible is God's word and this is God's best for humanity, then we need to talk about it with confidence. And I always say to people, by the way, what Speaker's Corner taught me was we can allow our Muslim friends to talk with confidence. I would never say to a Muslim, you mustn't share what you think. Let people share what they think, but we mustn't privilege. And I love the fact that your Islamophobia report piece, Tim, comes into this so often, I think several times, making that point. We're not arguing to privilege the voice of any religion in that sense. All religions need to be open to criticism. I have no problem with the new atheism criticizing Christianity. I think Dawkins is wrong, but I would defend his right to say that. And I think Islam needs to be subjected to the same criticism. But historically, I think Islam has run from criticism rather than embracing it. And in fact, Zaki Badawi, by the way, who you quote in the book, in your report, former chairman of the British Council of Mosques. I remember he said something once very interesting, very influential British Muslim in the 80s and 90s. Zaki once said, he said, the problem Islam has is Islamic theology is a theology of the majority. Being a minority was never seriously considered. And you see, Christianity began in minority. We were a small persecuted sect. Christians were for the first 300 years of the Christian era. And so Christians did lots of thinking early on about being a minority. Zaki's point is that apart from those first, you know, decade or so when Muhammad was in Mecca, from 622 AD onwards, Islam was always on the upper hand. And all of its theologizing happened when it was a great imperial power. And so Muslims today, one legacy we're living with, if you're a Muslim going back to your texts, and you talked about that Reformation idea, Tim, there is nowhere to go to answer the question, okay, what does it look like for me to be a Muslim living in a majority Western country? There are no answers because Islam never addressed that question.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and that's a good way to... Well, I was going to ask Tim, if any kind of final advice or thoughts to any Christian listening to this who...
Yeah, let's end on a note of hope. So what
concern. Yeah, anything you kind of think, what can you look forward to? You've been involved in some stuff. You've had some victories in some of these areas, of course. There's obviously challenges for Christians, but what can we look to point us towards some kind of positive signs given this time of new hope?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, really to emphasize what we've been talking about here, that what we need is a confident Christianity, really, that is unashamed and unafraid and bold in proclaiming the gospel and is unashamed of Christian values and so on. And I think that that's what needs to be recovered here. We didn't get a Christian culture with people just sort of, you know, being timid about their faith. You know, people had to be very strong and bold about it. And in order to maintain it, even preserve it, or possibly get back to it, you need Christians who are going to be strong, courageous, bold, unashamed, and proclaim Christian values strongly and all of that kind of thing. And I think, you know, that is what we need, and that is what I want to encourage and see and promote. You know, I co-wrote this book with Beth Pelter, Questions to Ask Your Muslim Friends, with that in mind, sort of give people a bit of confidence in the gospel and confidence to engage Muslims in conversations about faith, which they're most often very willing to do. And just to ask simple questions like, how did you become a Muslim? Or to compare Muhammad and Jesus? Or what difference is prayer making in your life? And then to perhaps go in a bit more detail in what the Quran actually teaches and so on. And I just want to encourage Christians to engage, to, I think increasingly, you know, new atheism, you know, we were all brought up to learn how to do apologetics against atheists. Well, actually, there aren't that many actual atheists out there, you know, and Islam is now growing in cultural relevance. And we need to start learning about apologetics in relation to Islam as well. Mm. And so, you know, I'm keen to see more of that taught and taught about, and people learning about Islam as well, and being, you know, confident then to challenge it and say, no, this is wrong, we don't agree with this, and Christianity is better, and Christianity is true, and Islam is false.
On that note, by the way, Tim, I think, I mean, so totally agree with that. One thing I would just say as well, Aaron, to encourage church leaders listening to this, because we know lots of church leaders listen to Pod of the Gaps. You know, I so often get asked to do evangelism training. I spend half my time doing evangelism training when I'm doing evangelism. Yeah. And I'm intrigued by the questions you get asked to address. And very, very rarely does a church say, oh, Andy, could you do a session on reaching Muslims? And we often have to push and advance that. And I think if you're a church leader listening to this, you've got the likes of Solas, you've got the likes of Tim, you've got others out there. Think about how you can equip your folks to be engaging Muslim friends. If you don't have Muslims in your community, you soon will eventually, but you know, in an inner city area. And I think, I mean, so many younger Christians who are desperate to learn how to do it. So if you're church leader listening to this, you know, invite Tim, invite others who can do it well, and learn how to share Christ with Muslims.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, that's a great point on which to end it. And once again, thanks, Andy, and thanks so much, Tim, for coming on today. And for
Enjoyed it.
It's been really good to have you. We'll put it's probably going to be quite a bumper show notes this week. There's quite a lot of things to add. A load of Tim stuff. There's Andy's book, of course, Do Christians and Muslims Worship the Same God? And then various Christian concern stuff, which people can point people to. But I hope you found it helpful, listeners. And just nothing else to say really, other than keep supporting the show, keep sharing, liking, subscribing, all of that normal podcasty stuff. And we'd look forward to speaking again in future, Tim. And thanks very much. Thank you. I've been Aaron Edwards. This has been Pod of the Gaps. That's been
Andy Bannister
and
Tim Dieppe.
Tim Dieppe. Farewell. I'll finish
one of these days. We'll end this podcast cleanly and
cleanly, like a lovely 747 coming into land. That's right.
And on that note,
anyway,
goodbye.
Farewell.